Good morning, it's Tavara Krasniansky from ADAAD, and it's March 24th in the morning. We're talking with Dr. David Pelkowitz about newlyweds and all this corona chaos. We also have several other important, valuable workshops on our website at adaiad.org/past-events. And you can find all kinds of important information there as well. And we'll just jump right into this talk with Dr. David Pelkowitz about newlyweds.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
It's been a long morning, and I've got a lot of questions that came in. I guess this is a topic that really touches lots of people. So I want to just jump right in. I want to thank you, Dr. Pelkowitz, for joining us this morning. I know you've been very busy, so I'm grateful that we have this time. And it is being recorded for those are not available to listen live. So as we spoke at the very beginning, when we talked about this, we had lots of questions, and since then many more questions have come in. So I just want to start off with talking, this is for newlyweds specifically, but really it's all very much the same for everyone who's cooped up, everyone is having, everyone's with each other a lot more than usual. So, while much of what we're going to say is relevant to everybody, we're going to try to keep the questions focused for more for newlyweds. Okay?
Right, right.
Okay.
Okay.
So, yeah, we hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. So do you want to read the questions, or should I read the questions, and we'll take it from there?
Okay. So I want to just talk about what are some things that are more specific to newlyweds rather than to all couples who are living together all of a sudden 24/7. Some of the things that came in as far as questions is that we barely know each other. We're talking about really newlyweds, but even people married over a year, and I don't even know how to support my spouse.
Right, right. Of course. So a couple of thoughts on that. I think one of the most important lessons to hold on to, especially in the early stage of a marriage, is to manage your expectations. You know, it's the actual reality of day-to-day life magnified by living together, you know, in enforced isolation and in small quarters, under one roof is going to be incredibly, incredibly challenging.
Share.
Yeah. So the what and by the way, that's true in any marriage. That's true. So I'm going to try to illustrate it with the example of the elevator example, which I got from Rabbi Dr. Johnny Krug. Okay, so the it goes like this. Can people mute themselves? Just press star six.
I'm muting them manually if I have to.
Okay, great. Okay, I think that's good. So here's the elevator story. Picture yourself in an elevator in the Empire State Building at the height of rush hour. So it's 5 to 9 in the morning, and you're going up, let's say, to the desk away, and I'll make my points in response to the questions.
Okay. So one of the questions that came in is that we have different attitudes about the virus, about stocking up, about how much we should stay inside. He's upset and that she doesn't care and doesn't want to be careful, and you know, she thinks that he's overdoing it.
Right. Okay. So again, and that's classic. It's classic, and it's happening. You know, I'm married for 43 years or something like that, and have a wonderful marriage. And my wife and I have completely different styles when it comes to that issue, right? You know, I'd be more comfortable if we were already buying a certain amount to get ready for Pesach, and she says, "Don't worry, it'll be okay. I've done this 43 times before. I'm ready." And she has a whole different style. what I've learned over time is to not take it personally. She's learned to try to understand my needs in this area and to try to be flexible and maybe be a little more stocked than she feels is necessary. And I've learned that she usually knows best, and I've learned to accept her different ways of doing things. But the key is to try to develop an approach that's informed by understanding that couples don't have to think alike. They have to think together. And the idea is that don't, in other words, if you start to believe this is a terrible sign, it means we're not really compatible. For each other, the equivalent of honeymooning. I can't believe that we're forced to, have these kind of disagreements. On the contrary, a very helpful way of thinking about this is to view marriage as a people growing machine. A number of marital therapists talk about it that way. That not only is conflict inevitable, but we grow through the conflict. So, for example, and this happens all the time, okay, I'm going to post a PowerPoint that I'll tell people how to get, how to go online to get this PowerPoint. It'll go into this in much more detail. But here's an example. When I, and this is true in all marriages in one way or another, so I'm going to use an example with promptness, okay? I came from a family where we're being prompt. And coming to things exactly on time was very much built into the culture of my family. And I thought that's the way all families were. You know, my father, who was a rabbi, was Rabbi the Weitschel for 65 years in Far Rockaway. He used to, the funeral was called for 11 a.m. He would start it at 11 a.m. even if the mess wasn't there yet. He literally... He was a terrific guy and a very beloved guy, but he was a real yucky when it came to time, okay? Now, with God's sense of humor, I married a woman from an unbelievably wonderful family, but they, 11 o'clock to them might have meant 11 in the morning, it might have meant 11 at night. It's totally different approaches to time. And we, by the way, we tend to marry people who help us work out exactly the things we need to work out in life. So as soon as we were married, as we're getting ready to go to the first wedding we were invited to in our marriage, I was already in the car, ready to go for the 6:30 opening of the wedding, the 6:30 smorgasbord, because I knew, based on my knowledge of time, this is pre-computer era, that, you know, I had to leave for the 6:30 smorgasbord about 6:11. And I call up to my wife to say, okay, I'll be waiting in the car. And she wasn't even beginning to think about what dress to wear. What happened over the last 43 years? Exactly what needed to happen. I needed to learn to be more relaxed about time. I needed to learn to expand my level of comfort, to become exactly what I needed to become, which is to, you know, less rigid and constricted about things like time and scheduling. She, wanting to please me like I wanted to please her, she became much more careful about time. If you were a fly on the wall at any of our recent weddings or recent simchas, before our world was turned upside down by the COVID virus, if you were a fly on the wall, what you would have seen is that she's on average now ready 15 minutes before I am. She often has to wait for me, and it's not a source of tension anymore. But it took years of working on ourselves in exactly the areas we needed to work on. And that's the key. The key is it's a matter of expectations. When you're struggling with differences, don't see it as a sign of this is a terrible thing. See it, okay, this is an engine of growth. Of course it's frustrating. The key is to be able to strike when the iron is cold, talk it out when you're calm. Don't talk it out in the heat of the moment. Find a quiet time to be able to discuss it. And again, remember the three words in the Sefer Chassidim, going back to the Middle Ages, Achris Kitata Charata. After argument, there's regret. You'll never regret it if you just bite your tongue for a little bit and then go and talk about it. But the most important thing is to realize this is marriage. And one more thought, because I think it's a cornerstone thought. In the fourth parak of Yevamos, the fourth chapter of the Mishnah Yevamos, it says the following insight into the very meaning of the Hebrew word for marriage. It says the Hebrew word for marriage has the following lesson. The inevitable differences between husband and wife that are built in can either be a masa. Masa is a burden, something that weighs us down, something that cripples us with anxiety and anger and upset. Or if we understand it at a deeper level and see this is what marriage is about, the Hebrew word masa, again, embedded in the word nesuin, it also means a song or something that's transcendent, something of beauty, something that's elevating. And to the extent that we could view any stress in our life as an instrument for growth, it totally changes the impact of the stress in a way that it becomes actually something that's growth-inducing rather than crippling.
Okay. So you mentioned a few things that I wanted to build on. To strike when the iron is cold, but how would we start a conversation later about it? I mean, nonetheless, it's frustrating nonetheless, but what would be a nice way to start it? Because many times these young couples don't yet have the skills of being married. Can you give some language or some things to consider?
Right. And by the way, let me start. I'll respond to that. It's an excellent question. But let me just say something, because maybe I didn't say it at the beginning. But it is totally, totally understandable that there's going to be frustrations and that this is difficult. You're all having a normal reaction to an abnormal event. You know, if very seasoned couples are having a hard time, you know, and if, you know, we know from the research that there's been a real spike in marital stress as a result of, you know, different levels of seclusion, you would almost have to be, it would be shocking if you weren't experiencing this. That's number one. Number two, probably what would be helpful, even though it may not sound terribly natural, it would be to build into the routine of your marriage something that I think is extremely helpful anyway, which is your newlyweds, you're hanging out like, you know, unreasonably long periods of time in a confined space, to try to find a place and a time, again, if you're allowed to walk outside a little bit, depending on your living situation and what, you know, whether or not you're allowed to walk outside, but to try to find a time and a place, not in the heat of the moment, to be able to take a step back, not because of any particular incident, and just to talk things out. It's a myth to say that you have to talk things out before you go to sleep. Now, there's this myth, you never go to sleep angry at each other. That's actually not what the research in marriage shows. It shows that you have to learn how to fight fair, but you also have to learn how to talk things out. But the key is to try to do it in a way that you find that time in the PowerPoint that I'll send all of you if you want to download it. There's something called the speaker-listener technique that goes into very specific kinds of guidelines on how to have a conversation where everybody takes turns. You know, so for
we lost you. Oh, no.
Do you hear me okay now?
Yes, we do.
Yeah, hi. Do you hear me?
I hear you now, yeah.
Oh, good. Okay, I don't know what happened. Sorry about that. Yeah, so...
I don't know what's going on. I don't want to do this.
Yeah, okay. So we could just ask people to mute themselves. Press star mm-hmm. 6 to mute yourself. Okay, thanks so much. Okay, great. Okay. The key is, I don't want to make things too complicated. If there's any way to get some privacy, to set a time, just to talk things out, how are things going? It's called relationship maintenance. To be able to talk about how are things going, is there anything, you know, talk about, first of all, probably the key thing is to nurture fondness and admiration for each other. That's extremely helpful. To remember why you married this guy. Remember why you married this woman. And to consciously think about it. You know, when we spend some time nurturing and savoring what our partner is doing for us, that could be extremely helpful. But then to be able to sit down and talk from a position of strength and say, you know, let's just talk things out in terms of maybe things that would be helpful. But the key is to do it without personal attack. Don't use you statements. Use I statements. I get frustrated when I'm the one who has to take out the garbage. I get upset when you're spending much more time with your mother and father than with me. You know, and to do it using I statements, and don't drag in the kitchen sink. The usual guideline there is talk about only one thing at a time. Have your partner your spouse paraphrase what it is that he or she thinks you're saying. And then after you feel heard, the speaker becomes the listener and the listener becomes the speaker. And it's very clearly laid out in a step-by-step way in a section of the PowerPoint called the speaker-listener technique.
So we'll share that PowerPoint with the recording as well.
Great.
Okay. So as far as language, when you have a specific frustration, so you said to use I statements, but I've found some people are writing that they don't want to upset their new spouse. So we're saying it's okay to bring it up because you have to bring it up. You can't just bottle it up.
Yeah, again, another excellent and important point. What the research shows on, you know, sort of like how to nurture and nourish a successful marriage over time is obviously you have to choose your battlegrounds. It's always safe to ignore certain things if it's not important to you, and to say to yourself, "Lo chashuv, this is not so important," and let me, you know, let it go. But if you're really frustrated and you sit on it, it's going to spill out. You know, there's this concept in the research of Dr. Gottman, you know, one of the leading marital therapy researchers in the world at the University of Washington in Seattle, and Dr. John Mordechai Gottman talks about how what actually becomes problematic for couples is when they avoid talking about things that are really important, as opposed to learning how to talk about it in a healthy, respectful kind of way, you know. And again, to do it not when you're super upset or super angry, but every once in a while, sit down and be able to talk it out. Now, if you're feeling you're fine with it, like let's say you say, "Hey, look, I'm not so upset about this. You know, it's not important enough, especially early in our marriage, for me to make a big deal out of it." As long as you're not frustrated, then that's one thing. But if you're really frustrated, and it's something that's really costing you, and you're your stomach is twisting inside of you, and you're just sort of like, find that your pulse rate is going up, and you have nobody to talk to because you're all cooped up, and you know, there's no easy opportunities for exercise or anything like that, then it's really important to talk about it. And just sort of say, you know, let's find the time to talk about things. Everything is great. I want to talk about how everything's great, but I also want to talk about certain things that I think will make our marriage even better if we're able to talk about, because I know there are things I need to work on, and let's talk about it as a couple in terms of things as we're getting to know each other that we both need to work on.
Yeah, I mean, in general, it's like a check-in. How are we doing as a couple? You know, like a month ago, we would have suggested that as well.
Absolutely, yeah. Almost everything we're saying is always true. You know, and by the way, if I could just say one more thing, and I don't want to sound like some kind of Pollyanna here, but as incredibly stressful as this all must be, and I can't even imagine how, you know, all of you have had a shift, you know, so many of your dreams and aspirations and hopes about what a wedding is going to be, what the early period of your marriage was going to be. You know, I think that it's really important to give yourself permission to feel incredibly frustrated. You know, one of the core ingredients of resilience is to allow yourself to feel frustrated, to allow yourself at times to cry. Tears release stress hormones. I'm not saying that you should do it in front of everybody, but to allow the emotions to wash over you, and maybe even, you know, if it's just you and your spouse alone, to do it in front, you know, to allow it. Because when we don't allow it, it could be somewhat problematic. You know, in terms of the core ingredients of resilience, you know, a lot of it is to be able to really allow in both positive and negative feelings, but not to fight it, to let it wash over you. It's part of being human. Is there going to be times that you want to kill each other? Part of you being human is there are times that you incredibly love each other and enjoy being together. But if you don't fight it and you give yourself permission to have human emotions, paradoxically, it allows those emotions to be honored and put in their proper kind of place.
Okay. This couple writes that they got married earlier than they thought, so this must be like very, very new couple, and they are living with her parents, and they're finding that extremely difficult. So we can talk to the parents and talk to the couple.
Sure. So, again, in this PowerPoint I have a whole section, and I also have a chapter I wrote in a book on this, on, you know, strategies for living with in-laws in our community. I'll see if I could dig it up. If you remind me, I'll send you that also to share. But the bottom line on all of that is let me just give you a couple of core guidelines on that. Number one, and this is probably really difficult, you know, al kenyazo vicious aviv vasimo, okay? The first rule of any marriage is going to be that you have to validate the reality that in this new couple, the spouse comes first. Doesn't mean that you don't continue to respect and love and honor the parents, but in terms of loyalty, the spouse comes first. So let me just review with you a couple of general guidelines on all of this, okay? Families differ in two global areas, okay? So, you know, when anybody gets married, they figure that the new couple is going to be like the family we grew up with, because we've never been exposed to anything else. And it's only after you're married that you realize that, you know, as one of my professors used to say, there are two kinds of people. There are normal people and people I know. And as you get to know people, it becomes, you start to see things that may look totally crazy to you. So it's two general dimensions the family differ on. One is in terms of rigid versus chaotic, the rule structure of the family. Some families have a very rigid rule structure in terms of time, in terms of what's expected. And others on the other dimension, the other end of that dimension, are very chaotic. They go to sleep very late. There isn't a lot of respecting of boundaries. They'll walk in on you at all times. So those are the extremes, either an overly rigid or overly chaotic rule structure. The healthiest rule structure is in the middle. But something that's sometimes helpful is when you could see it that way and say, okay, this is very hard for me. Because what's hard for me about my new in-laws is they seem to be, especially if you came from a very organized family and they're very chaotic, it's easy to say, oh, they're out of their minds. I can't believe I married into this Meshuggah family. And you need to say, no, this is what people do for a living sometimes, and you normalize it. So that's one thing, is to try to give specific recommendations in a minute. But then there's the issue of, in terms of intimacy. Intimacy meaning I'm not talking about intimacy in the physical sense. I'm talking about enmeshed versus disengaged, meaning that some families, total blurring of the boundaries. A mother-in-law might say to you, put on a sweater, I'm cold, versus disengaged, where they're not even talking to you because they are into their own thing, and they're very emotionally cold. And again, here you want something right in the middle between the two. So what do you do when you have it? Okay. So some of the recommendations are that each of you has to break the code, meaning there's a hidden family rule book that you know about. So in this case, if it's the husband who's having a hard time with his new in-laws who he's living with, it's the responsibility of your wife to explain what the playbook of her family is. Because nobody gives you the real set of rules until there's a penalty on the play, okay? So you need open communication with your spouse to educate one another about the culture of the family. Now, it may be hard to see it because you grew up with it, but now through the eyes of your husband, you're going to be able to see it in a clearer kind of way, which could ultimately be very, very helpful, okay? That's that. The key is communication. So, communication between the two of you on how you understand your parents, on trying to explain their perspective to your husband. Also in a respectful but assertive way between son-in-law and mother-in-law and father-in-law, that we hope you respect our style. You need to take the side of your spouse for now. That's going to be the healthiest thing for the marriage, but in a respectful way, okay? So the mother-in-law and father-in-law have to learn how to bite their tongue, okay? So that's on communication. You need to clarify. The key is open and clear communication, okay? And then to explore with your wife and with each of you a coping plan for dealing with your frustrations with your in-laws. Like, talk about, what helps you cope? Everybody has different coping styles. Are you helped by being able to just go outside for a walk if you're able to do that, or to be able to go running in place, or to be able to read a good book or to learn? And so if your in-laws are criticizing you, to maybe just listen and then to save it up for when you have time alone with your wife to come up with a coping plan. It might be distraction. It might be setting up a call meeting to discuss it with one another. But the key is to name the monster, okay? You have to be allowed to vent with one another in a calm, protected kind of way. Okay, and the spouse, in this case your wife, needs to learn to validate without agreeing, meaning that you could say, I really understand where you're coming from, and I can understand how what my father said is driving you absolutely crazy. That doesn't mean that you're necessarily agreeing with his upset, but you could validate with that agreement. They're two different things, okay? And to say, it sounds like you had a really tough time today with my mother, or you had a really tough time today with my father. To name the monster is often conquer it. Okay? And again, I have very specific guidelines that you could see in the PowerPoint or in the chapter that I'm happy to send to you.
Okay, well, thank you. Okay, this question, the wife is pregnant, and her doctor's recommendation, she cannot leave the house, and the husband cannot leave the house. So they're really in, and they're in a small Brooklyn apartment, and they're driving each other crazy.
Wow.
So he wants to know, and I guess, I mean, first of all, that's a wow in itself, but he wants to know how to, and again, I'm assuming they're newlyweds, to say nicely, I need my space from you.
Yeah, so there's all kinds of interesting research that's come out on what research shows on how to handle a quarantine in a way that is in a way that preserves our sanity. None of this is going to guarantee that this is going to be stress free, but let me share with you what the research seems to be saying. So number one, it's to the extent that you could focus on the fact that you're doing this for altruistic reasons. It's an act of love to stay together in the house. That you're doing it to protect your baby, you're doing it to protect each other, you're doing it to protect the community. To the extent that you could see it as voluntary in that way, it really could help quite a bit. Another finding of the research, which is not going to be surprising to anybody, and I know it's not easy, but it's to switch the channel to focus on what you have instead of to focus on what you don't have. That's a core ingredient of being able to cope according to that research. So the power of gratitude is phenomenally important, okay? So I'm just going to share with you, let me just quickly get my notes on, well, actually, I'll just, rather than do that, let me just, okay, I'm going to, okay. I'm going to share with you the core ingredients of resilience when you're quarantined. Again, none of this, the key, okay, is to allow yourself to experience the full range of emotions, and you're going to have stress, you're going to have anger, you're going to have all of that mixed up with love and admiration, and let it flow through you, because all emotions flow through one top pipeline. I'm quoting from Dr. Tal Ben-Shachar, who's a leading expert on resilience during this epidemic. So what Dr. Ben-Shachar says, if I block one, I'm not allowing joy and love room. So you allow it. Give yourself permission. And he quotes Golda Meir. So Golda Meir says, those who don't know how to weep with their whole heart don't know how to laugh either. So that's an incredibly important coping mechanism. Then there's the stuff you've been hearing, but it really is important. So it might be just giving yourself permission to talk about your feelings, and if you can't because you're too pent up, write, you know, you journal. Okay, even if it's just for 5 minutes, you put your thoughts and feelings onto paper. Don't worry about anybody reading it. Don't worry about grammar. Just writing. There's a lot of fascinating research that shows that the power of writing for 20 minutes a day when under stress is actually, it's very good for your immune system functioning, probably going to be good for the baby, it's probably good all along. And to allow tears at times. Again, it's like I said before, tears release stress hormones, and that could be extremely helpful. Okay? Or as Dr. Ben Shachar says, if we want to fulfill happiness, we need to allow unhappiness. Okay? I know that it may sound trite to talk about gratitude, but gratitude is a fundamental Jewish value. It's really pivotal, and it's associated with better health. It's associated with happiness, and it's relatively easy to do, to just keep a journal where you write, even if it's, every day, just think about three things to be grateful for. Write it. Share it with your spouse. Share it with other people who are in your apartment together. In this case, share it with your spouse. Counting blessing exercises is extremely, extremely important. Okay? And you can always find something to be grateful for, you know, even in this kind of crazy situation you're living with. It might be a great meal. It might be a smile. By the way, to push yourself to smile, my grandchildren and my children want to kill me because I'll often say to them, smile for 7 seconds. But you know what happens when you smile for 7 seconds? It causes certain internal changes where you start to feel a little bit happier. But the key to gratitude is don't keep it only to yourself. It's much more effective if we find a way to share it, and we find a way maybe to focus on it in our tefillos, you know, depending on, you know, whether or not spirituality and prayer is a channel for you. So I don't know if there's a place for exercise. It sounds like there isn't. But not exercising is like taking a depressant. So if there's any way to just figure out a way, I don't know quite how to tell you how to do it, be it running in place or being it downloading, you know, from online different kinds of stretching exercises or things like that. It's found to be as effective as the most powerful medications. It releases dopamine, epinephrine, and it becomes a real necessity.
Okay. This question, thank you. My husband is not feeling well, but he doesn't want to eat or drink, and I don't want to nag him.
Right. And is it he's been medically checked out, I figure out. They know what it's coming from, or is it possible that it's related to this, to the virus?
Let's assume it's this, but it's, you know, can stay home. But still, the people are saying to, you need calories to fight this. You need to drink, and it's just like laying in bed doing nothing, which is understandable. But I'm guessing her question, she doesn't want to nag him, doesn't know him enough how to convince him to eat or drink.
Yeah, well, listen, nagging and lecturing really rarely works in terms of compliance. It probably has the opposite effect. We all know that. When's the last time that anybody, remember back to your teenage years, did your parents nagging that you have to make your bed or clean your room or take out the garbage ever lead to your answering, oh, thank you so much, Mommy. I'd be delighted to make my bed, and while I'm making my bed, I'll even make yours and Daddy's. It's just not the way people work. So nagging, even on a medical issue, is probably not going to be extremely helpful. Usually the recommendations, there's a whole science to compliance for medical stuff, but it's probably, you know, you could get some strategies from your doctor, get some strategies from the various medical staff in your doctor's office on it. I wrote an article, well, forget it, it's going a little too far afield, but it's talking about that you try to give as much choice as you can. So if he's resisting drinking altogether, maybe if you give him the illusion of choice by saying, look, you know, if you want to, I understand this is totally up to you, here's three possibilities. Here's some ice chips, here's some seltzer, and here's some orange juice or whatever. When you give people the illusion of choice, they may be more likely to do it. You know, to listen to you. You know, to do one of the things. You know, so those kind of strategies might be helpful.
Mm-hmm. I'm definitely not saying you don't care about me. If you know, if you're going to get sick on me, that kind of thing is not going to work.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, it's not the way relationships work. You know. Look, if you see it through the eyes of the patient, of the sick husband. I know this is terrifying. You're newlyweds and you're dealing with this. So if you see it through the eyes of the sick person, you know, he's lost his independence. He's lost even the right to have a normal kind of convalescence, you know. The one place that he has some control is here. So the key guideline here is to be understood, first understand. So show empathy, show understanding, get it, allow him to vent. And then try to see whether or not, you know, some of the strategies that we're talking about might be somewhat helpful, including maybe most importantly, getting advice from your medical team.
Okay. This question. The wife's grandfather is very ill. I don't know how to support her. She's crying a lot.
Right. So this is, so who's very ill? The parent?
The wife's grandfather.
Oh, he's in the hospital?
I'm assuming. Let's just assume that's the scenario.
Right, right. And that's been one of the most horrifically challenging, issue for many, many people, is to have somebody we really love who we can't go visit and we can't, we can't be there. We can't be there for them. And I'll say things that I've said before, and none of them is going to be terribly satisfying, but let me at least share with you a couple of things. Number one is remember Ashrei Yishur, like I said before, right? Highest level of happiness. The word Ashrei is tied to Yishur, to the word to validate. So allow her to be upset. Give her full permission to be upset. Remember that honoring a person's right to express strong feelings is paradoxically helps the person get better control over those feelings. To use some of those other strategies that we were talking about, which, you know, obviously the first thing is to the extent possible to try to arrange whatever communication could be arranged, you know, with writing letters, with FaceTime, or with whatever the medical system is allowing in terms of that, would be, you know, incredibly important. Even if you don't think that the grandparent is able to read it, just writing it can be helpful, and having it read to him could be helpful beyond what you could even imagine. Very often people who have been very seriously ill, when they get better, they'll say, you know something, I heard that. People even who have been in a coma for a while, who then when they get better, if they get better, God willing, they're impacted much more than one could imagine by being able, if you're allowed to. Now, it could be you're not allowed to. It could be that the medical system is so overtaxed that there's no easy way to get that kind of information in. But that's okay. Write the letters. Mail them. Try to figure out a way to get it to the patient, to the grandfather, to the extent that you can. But again, the key is to give yourself permission to talk about it, to cry about it, to be human about it, to be frustrated, and then to figure out how to, in some way, now again, some people will have a religious kind of reaction. You know, for some people, tefillah might be incredibly helpful. Or some kind of taking on some, if this is a grandparent who's very into charity and kindness, to bring that into your life or into other people's lives. There are many ways when we don't have control over a situation, we always have control over the meaning we make of it. And to the extent that we're able to try to somehow, you know, focus on what we have control over, it could actually be very, very, you know, very much a source of comfort. But again, I know that as I'm saying it, I realize how inadequate these words are.
Of course. Someone writes this question. I'm hearing how difficult it is to be a newlywed. Should I get married this week?
I forgot that there are people listening who haven't gotten married yet. That's such a personal, individual kind of question. I mean, should you wait and then get married in more normal times? Because there's every reason to have hope that things will normalize. I can't tell you what to do there. There you have to decide. But what I would say is going back to the original ideas, you know, the original thoughts that we started with, which is basically as crazy and as stressful as this all seems, what I'm seeing between the lines of every question is a tremendous amount of love and concern for one another. And to the extent that the key to marriage is to get to really know each other, not only in good times and not only in romantic times, but also to get to know each other even in stressful times and to be there for each other and to learn how to, you know, be at each other's side in a time of incredible stress, that has its own incredible advantages. So you'll be able, and I think about all of the marriages, and I know this is not in any way to take away from the validity of what everybody's feeling, but, you know, there's so many marriages, be it through during the times of the Holocaust or during the long history of Jews that had to be done under crazy kind of circumstances. And I think the thing is you're in a long tradition of people whose marriages started out during times of persecution or times of plague or times of, you know, terrible financial pressures. And you know what? It ultimately became a source of strength. You have to know yourself. You have to know whether or not, I'm saying, it may be valid to hold off. It may be valid to say, no, let's do this. But that's something that you have to, based on your knowledge of each other and how you deal with stress together and your ability to communicate, you know, I think there's a strong argument for getting married. But I certainly understand if you decide to wait till a more opportune time.
Yeah, and again, speak to your Rav. This wasn't a halacha question. This was more from a doctor's perspective.
Oh yeah. Let me say that. Let me clarify it. There isn't anything I'm saying that isn't 100% coming purely from psychology. And I have no right to be talking about anything from a halakhic standpoint. I'm by no means, you know, in a position to speak about this stuff from anything. Maybe I could talk about it from a Jewish philosophical standpoint, but I'm no rabbi.
Okay. Okay. So we've been talking almost an hour. I have several questions, but I think I'm going to wrap up with this one. This couple writes, we're newlyweds and we deserve a normal Shana Rishona. I guess that goes to expectations. You want to just like wrap up on expectations?
Wow. And you're right. You 100% deserve a normal Shana Rishona. You are 100% allowed to feel frustrated and robbed and angry and to see that this is just totally and utterly unfair. It's as valid a feeling as a person can have. I can't imagine not feeling it. Okay? And all that's in your control, I can't tell you what to do or how to do it. It depends on your personality. It depends on your style. It's just that over the long term, this Shana Rishona could become an engine of growth and I'm not saying it's a minimize. I'm just saying it could become an engine of growth, because we always have the opportunity to look at any stress in our life, either from the standpoint of understandably feeling angry and hurt and cheated, which is completely valid, or to see whether or not there's something that we could squeeze out of this in terms of strengthening our relationship. It says in Medrash Tehillim, the magnificent Falti Lo Kamti, if I never fell down, I never would have gotten up. If I never sat in the darkness, I never would have appreciated the light. And to be able to focus on that, to focus on how to transform our feelings, to see some of the growth potential in all the research on stress that's been found to be, especially when things are out of our control, to be something that facilitates a more resilient kind of reaction. And that in no way undoes the permission to be human. It's that balance. You're allowed to feel both, but you also, to the extent that when you're ready, to be able to focus on some of the growth-inducing aspects of spending the beginning time of your marriage together, being at each other's side. And I'll just end with my favorite study, which I probably quote too much, but this is a good way to end. It's the research on people standing on the bottom of a hill. See, they take two people. They have them stand on the bottom of a hill. And they say, estimate the steepness of this hill. If you're alone, you see the hill is very steep. If you have somebody at your side, you see the hill as less steep. The closer you are to the person at your side, the less steep the hill looks and the less tired you get walking up the hill. And may we all be privileged as you're going through this, very challenging and stressful, but potentially growth-inducing period, to walk together hand in hand and side by side as you face the challenges that that COVID-19 has brought to us. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. This has been very, very helpful. So you'll send me the PowerPoint, and I'll put it together with the recording.
I'll send you the PowerPoint. Great. Okay. You got it.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. I'm
sure,
actually getting thank yous coming in as text, so they're to you. Thank you.
Thank you.